The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Great to be with you. This week, a pair of New York Times reporters go after Judge Kavanaugh.
Pretty much nothing that was reported in the Times was accurate.
And their key witness is not much of a witness after all.
The woman who is claimed to have been the victim in this case has no memory of it.
There are deepening concerns about Joe Biden.
I think there's something wrong with him. I think he is having a medical issue of some sort.
And we'll look at a gruesome discovery on the property of a former abortionist.
What kind of an evil, fallen, disgusting fetish could this be?
We have all this and more. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. You can catch me online at WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. Last weekend, the New York Times ran a big headline that read, "Brett Kavanaugh fit in with the privileged kids, she did not." The she in this headline is Deborah Ramirez, the woman who accused Kavanaugh of inappropriate behavior while at Yale. She famously didn't remember the incident until, quote, 6 days of carefully assessing her memories and consulting with her attorney. Justice Kavanaugh, you surely remember, faced the most ugly and absurd smear job in the history of Supreme Court nominations. But he was confirmed and has settled in well in his new job. However, to those on the left, the issue remains unsettled. Molly Hemingway co-authored the book Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. She discussed the New York Times hit piece with Kevin McCullough on AM 570, The Mission in New York City.
You saw the story as it was bubbling up. I saw people on Saturday starting to tweet about it, and it was you know, they were hook, line, and sinker. If you were the least left of center, you started retweeting this saying, this is the bombshell of all bombshells. In reality, Molly, what was the news value of what was reported in the Times over the weekend?
Nothing that was reported in the Times was accurate. They claimed there was a new allegation of sexual misconduct. Nothing about that is true. Beginning with, it's not new. This is something that was brought forward to Democratic senators last year, and they didn't even take it seriously enough to share it with the Senate Judiciary Committee. That means it didn't even meet the standard of the rape boat in Rhode Island or the nationwide crime spree allegations that they did share with the Senate Judiciary Committee. There is confusion about what is actually being alleged. This story says they heard from someone who heard from someone that he saw something happen, and the book quietly notes that the alleged victim in the case, and it's not even clear exactly what's being alleged, but the alleged victim says she has no recollection of this incident as described by the third hand party. So there's no victim, there's nothing new, and there's not even a clear allegation of any wrongdoing by Kavanaugh. Basically, the version of events told by allegedly by this Democrat Clinton attorney is that he saw a group of guys be inappropriate with Brett and a lady in his freshman class. So it's not even clear why this would be something of concern for Brett Kavanaugh. Yet this led the nightly news. Every major media outlet went wild with it. I read the book over the weekend and saw that they had neglected to mention that the alleged victim has no memory of any such incident and has said that through multiple friends. And they were forced to update the piece with a correction, although they don't call it a correction. They call it a note.
Yeah, well, and it's something that they put on page 28 when the original story ran on page one.
Exactly.
So, well, let's talk about this for a second, because this actually scares me to death. Molly, because it's getting to the point now, and I just did a small little talk for the Bergen County Republicans last week, and some people pulled up some things that I had supposedly said, you know, 15 years ago that they didn't have sourcing on and a number of other things. The day and age in which we live right now, and if people oppose you and they think that you're a Trump supporter, or they think that they disagree with you on some major issue, there seems to be no limit on the willingness that they will engage and on the amount of slander that they may resort to in order to try to make their point come across. Are we living in a day where journalism is just expected to be this way from now on? How do we turn this boat around? Is it even possible?
It is overwhelming to witness it in action and how little concern they have for getting facts right or getting truth in any way out there. But I think that, you know, this is a big reason why we wrote the book we did, Justice on Trial. We wanted to not just lay out the actual facts before the media began reimagining them in a more favorable way.
Somehow you knew they were going to.
But we knew they were going to, and we actually even talk about that. We talk about how there is this campaign to redefine history, how it's been witnessed with previous judicial nominees, such as Clarence Thomas, how and why they do that to delegitimize the Supreme Court, because it is this means by which they would like to force change when the people don't want it. And when you look at the most contentious decisions of the Supreme Court, it's when they have forced a change over and against the will of the people in an extra-constitutional manner. So that's why they care so much about the court. That's why they're willing to destroy a man who, like, probably has one of the best reputations of any man in America. But this gets to the other thing, which is, in the last couple of years, we've seen this attempt to just overthrow an election with the Russia hoax. It technically failed in that there was the special counsel was unable to find any evidence of any American colluding with Russia to steal the 2016 election. But it still achieved its desired outcome. It ruined a lot of people's lives. It made people scared to associate with the Republican Party. It drove the news for years. People looked at that, though, and they kind of said, some people didn't like it. Other people said, well, Trump is kind of a shady character. To see what they're doing to Kavanaugh clarifies everything. It clarifies that the left will stop at nothing to destroy people or to throw a tantrum over an election that they lost fair and square.
Dr. Albert Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, ran through the details of this smear from long before the New York Times piece to the most recent allegations. Here's a portion of that discussion from The Briefing.
There's actually no precedent for the controversy and tumult in the confirmation process and the hearings for Judge Kavanaugh. For example, you can only explain it by the fact that there was the intersection of all the controversy already built up about the Supreme Court and then the collision with the Me Too movement. And that movement gave the opponents of Justice Kavanaugh some ammunition to use against him, at least during the controversy and the hearings. At the center of the controversy and the accusations against Judge Kavanaugh stood Christine Blasey Ford, who accused the future judge and justice of having attempted some form of sexual assault during the time that both were high schoolers operating in rather fast circles of adolescence in suburban Virginia. There was also an accusation made by a woman who'd been a fellow student to Brett Kavanaugh at Yale. I'll refer to the charge here as coming down to an inappropriate personal exposure. There were hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee that involved both Judge Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford. It was high-pitched emotionally and, of course, politically as well. And at the end of the day, most of the people who had been supporters of Brett Kavanaugh continued to be his supporters, disbelieving Christine Blasey Ford. And those who opposed him at least said they believed Christine Blasey Ford's accusations and that they were sufficient to deny Judge Kavanaugh a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, a lifetime appointment. There were many lessons from that controversy and confirmation process, but at least one of those lessons was the extreme difficulty of providing true evidence over time in incidents that took place so long ago when the participants were either adolescents or young adults. I'm not going to mention the names of all the persons involved, but the article that appeared on Sunday centered in the charges that had been made by a second woman, the woman who had been a student with Kavanaugh at Yale. But the article by Pogrevin and Kelly that appeared in the New York Times on Sunday was an excerpt from their forthcoming book entitled The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, An Investigation. And they basically presented themselves as having carried out an extensive investigation. And they also made very clear that in their investigation, they were doing their very best to find corroborative evidence for the charges made against Kavanaugh by the woman who had been the fellow student at Yale. Once again, they didn't draw much in terms of evidence at all. They did claim to have found persons who corroborated the account or who corroborated someone's memory of the account or someone else's memory of the account, but they didn't basically come up with anything new except one thing. The explosive revelation that was presented in the New York Times on Sunday was that the investigative reporters had uncovered a man who had been a fellow student with Kavanaugh at Yale who remembered that Kavanaugh had actually exposed himself to yet another female student. This was dated to the time that Brett Kavanaugh was a freshman at Yale, presumably age 18. In their article, the reporters said, quote, "We also uncovered a previously unreported story about Mr. Kavanaugh in his freshman year that echoes," the other woman's name is mentioned here, "her allegation. The man who had been Kavanaugh's classmate at Yale, who's identified in the story, is not identified very fully, but it is said that he told the reporters, or at least he provided the information to the reporters, that there had been this other incident. That's where the story broke on Sunday, and it broke with a great deal of controversy. But the New York Times had actually posted the article electronically on Saturday. And at the same time, the New York Times entered into a vast controversy when it tweeted what amounted to an obscene tweet advertising its own news story, or at least the story identified as news analysis. Hold on to that for just a moment. The New York Times had to take down the tweet and had to apologize for it. But then, and follow the story, the New York Times story was in print on Sunday. It was posted electronically on Saturday. On Sunday, in the electronic edition, the editor's note that was appended to the story, that means a correction, basically, to the story, stated this, quote, "An earlier version of this article, which was adapted from a forthcoming book, did not include one element of the book's account regarding an assertion by a Yale classmate that friends of Brett Kavanaugh," then follows the description of the exposure. Then it says, quote, "The book reports that the female student declined to be interviewed, and friends say that she does not recall the incident. That information," said the editor's note, "has been added to the article," end quote. Now, wait just a minute. The New York Times claims to have offered a news analysis written by two of its own reporters who are writing a forthcoming book. Keep in mind, this could have something to do with book sales. And the New York Times posted not only the article as an excerpt from the book, but they also tweeted about it. They posted a tweet that they had to take down because it had been acknowledged to be obscene and offensive. And then after they ran the story and supposedly broke the news of this second woman, only later, after the print edition had been distributed, did they add to the digital edition the editor's note that, wait just a minute, perhaps we should have put in that the woman who is claimed to have been the victim in this case has no memory of it. So this means that, ladies and gentlemen, we are right back in 2018. We're really right back where we started.
Coming up, the disturbing find in an abortionist's home.
What kind of an evil, fallen, disgusting fetish could this be?
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. The Democratic debate gave us plenty to think about.
Yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
While Beto O'Rourke has few worried that he'll actually get the nomination, the man leading the pack, Joe Biden, is 76 years old and already known for his gaffes. But lately, those gaffes seem even more bewildering, such as at the recent rally at which he couldn't remember Obama's name, the man he served under for 8 years. Kevin McCullough discussed the topic with Michael Goodwin, columnist for the New York Post.
play the radio. Make sure the television, make sure you have the record player on at night. The phone, make sure the kids hear words.
The phonograph. I'm convinced he was about to say the phonograph, not the phone. Anyway, there's a prominent editorial voice in America that is calling for Joe Biden, that voice that you heard right there, who, let's admit it, had a train wreck of a debate the other night. It's time for him to get out of the race. So says Michael Goodwin. So why are you calling for Joe Biden to get out?
Well, that incident that you referenced there is a big part of it. I do not believe that Joe Biden can go the distance. I think there's something wrong with him. I think he is having a medical issue of some sort. It may be chronic, it may be temporary, but it looks to me as if he has slipped a lot. And I've never been a big fan. I've always thought I'm sort of a career windbag. But I think what we're talking about here is something very different. And my thesis is that the Democrats, the other rivals, are starting to notice it. Julian Castro brought it up indirectly. Did you forget what you just said 2 minutes ago? I mean, it was a clear implication. Cory Booker later defended Castro, saying, look, we're all worried about this. Sometimes you listen to him and you just wonder. And he didn't have to say what we wonder about because everyone knows. So my point is that if he is going to implode, and I believe he will, then that so-called moderate lane, and it's all things being relative that Joe Biden is a moderate, is going to be empty. I mean, you have an Amy Klobuchar or maybe someone like that who might get a second look. But fundamentally, what is almost certain to happen is that Joe Biden exploding at some point in this campaign and having to drop out later would happen at a time when it's too late for anybody else to get in. And so it means Elizabeth
And then you're
Warren,
stuck with, yep.
Warren, probably, or Bernie Sanders. And I think it's not good for the country to have only one party appealing to the middle, because Warren and Sanders appeal only to the left and to the far left. And so I think that's not healthy for the country. I think there should be competition for the middle vote.
Let me ask you this, Michael, because I'm not a big fan, but this has been floated on more than one occasion, that if Biden goes down, it opens the door for one, Governor Andrew Cuomo, to put his hat forward at least and say, hey, I'm not like all the rest of them. Consider me. What's your take on whether or not something like that would be a fruitful endeavor?
Well, look, in the column I mentioned Michael Bloomberg and Andrew Cuomo as two New Yorkers who I think would run if there were time. Bloomberg, of course, the former mayor, the multi-billionaire former mayor, tested the waters and basically dropped out because of Biden. Yeah. Andrew Cuomo has said to a reporter, if Biden doesn't run, this was back, call me again. Meaning, so I think that Biden's decision to run, remember, that was up in the air for a while.
It
but
was.
When he finally decided to run, I think both of them thought they would not. Now, if he were to drop out, I mean, who knows? I mean, Howard Schultz, I think Biden is why Howard Schultz ran as an independent, because they thought that the party was too far left. And the support for Biden is significant in a sense that it shows there is still a reasonable chance for a somewhat moderate person to win the Democratic nomination.
Yeah.
I just don't think Joe Biden will be standing at the end of this.
Upon the death of abortionist Jurlik Klopfer, his family made a shocking discovery. Inside his home, they found the remains of over 2,200 preserved fetuses. While it takes a certain kind of evil to abort so many babies, as Klopfer had done, this was well beyond what anyone expected. Bob Burney discussed the disturbing case on WRFD 880 in Columbus, Ohio.
Dr. Ulrich Klopfer was an abortion doctor who passed away on September 3rd of this year. He was an abortion provider in South Bend, Indiana for many years. However, his license was suspended back in 2015 over multiple violations of state law. By the way, South Bend, Indiana, that is where Pete Buttigieg is the mayor. Mayor Pete, who's running for president of the United States. Yep, this is South Bend, Indiana. So anyway, his medical license was suspended back in 2015. He appealed on a number of occasions. He never did get his medical license back. Well, he died on September 3rd. His family started to go through his house, and they found something absolutely macabre and evil. This abortion doctor had been saving the bodies of aborted babies and preserving them in jars. How many? 2,246, quote, medically preserved aborted babies. What kind of an evil, fallen, disgusting fetish could this be? I have no idea where they were in there, his attic, his basement. 2,246 bodies of aborted babies. Somehow, in this man's perverted, twisted, evil mind, he got pleasure out of looking at the bodies of the babies that he had killed. And I would imagine that in most of these cases, this doctor assured the mother, I'll take care of the baby. You know, I'll make sure that the baby's taken care of. Yeah, he took the body home. Later in the story, Klopfer had his license to perform abortions suspended for numerous violations. Get this. Among them, performing an abortion on a 10-year-old girl who was raped by her uncle and then not reporting the rape to authorities. At a medical licensing board hearing held in August of 2016, Dr. Klopfer argued he was not obligated to report all incidents in which an underage girl becomes pregnant. He said, if I have a child, 13 or 14, coming to the clinic for an abortion with her mother or father or both, it doesn't mean in each and every case that it's child abuse. A 13-year-old that needs an abortion, a 13-year-old that's pregnant, that's not child abuse? An evil, evil man. He's dead. I am sure that right now he is facing the penalty for his evil deeds, but in God's hands. Again, let's watch to see if this case gets any national attention at all. And then secondly, if Mayor Pete Buttigieg has any comment at all about this sickening, grotesque, evil thing that was uncovered in his city.
Coming up,
there's been an amazing decline in abortion.
How the left is fighting that good news when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. The Christian Outlook podcast brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. Not long ago, the state of Virginia cracked down on abortion clinics that were clearly substandard medical operations. It set in motion a battle that is raging today. Instead of seeking to up their standards, supporters of abortion have worked to rid themselves of the requirements. Virginia Cobb is president of the Family Foundation in Richmond, Virginia. She joined me on The Don Crow Show on WAVA in Washington, D.C. Would you elaborate as to what's happening with the Virginia Board of Health and what the kind of the backstory of all this is?
Well, we have been in a battle for decades, really, over the safety standards at abortion centers. And in particular, this has heated up since back in 2011 when Governor McDonald and his team put in emergency regulations, which ultimately turned to permanent regulations that simply said, we're going to make sure these places are safe. We might not choose to ever take a human life ourselves, but we want to make sure that if a woman goes into these places and not going to lose their life as well as the life of the child. Also, we know, and we've been able to now watch over the last several years, there's been an amazing decline in abortion, and in large part because some of the clinics chose to close rather than step up to the plate and make sure their facilities are safe. So we've seen a 32% drop over 5 years in our abortion rate because of these standards. So the battle is raging, and it's been a back and forth. And unfortunately, under new governors, we have a new Board of Health. And when we have liberal governors, that means a liberal Board of Health. And so what we first saw was that they tried to water down these safety standards, but they were so zealous that they did it illegally. And so we took them to court, and we won. And so they had to restore all of the safety standards, or nearly all. There's one or two things that stuck, but they got to restore, much to their disappointment, nearly everything that we had originally put in place. But they're at it again.
Now, why? I know it's really a rhetorical question because it's an implied answer pretty strong. Why would anyone, whether you're pro-abortion or pro-life, why would one object to at least basic safety health standards in these clinics? What is their rationale?
Well, we certainly have asked ourselves that question so many times over this battle because it is stunning, too. I think anyone who can look at this objectively would say, we do think there should be life-saving equipment. We do think there should be sterilization processes. And since the safety standards have gone into place, we've seen hundreds upon hundreds of violations that include blood on the equipment, ill-trained staff, narcotics, moving between facilities without inventory, things that in any other world other than abortion, these places would come under fire. The public would be suing. But see, people don't realize with abortion, it isn't like any other medical practice. One, because we know it isn't healing, which is what medicine is all about. It's actually harming. But in the other sense, women who undergo an abortion are not wanting to come public with that decision. And so they don't sue a doctor when something goes wrong. Their complications are not adequately and correctly recorded at hospitals. And so there has to be some very careful government oversight. So what happened just now was that the Board of Health thought they were going to reinitiate a process to water these standards down again, do it legally this time, because they had basically been stopped in their tracks by our lawsuit. But there is another lawsuit. The abortion industry has decided to take basically every pro-life law you could imagine here in Virginia that is protecting the unborn. They've bundled them all up and thrown them into federal court and said, we want a judge to strike all of this down and say that it prevents access for women to abortion. And that is waiting on Judge Hudson to make a decision. We had a 10-day jury trial. Judge Hudson has to make a decision on whether he's going to uphold all those laws. So what actually happened last week is the Board of Health said, we know we're going to do this. We're definitely going to water these things down. But if the court will do it for us, you know, just ignore the whole lawmaking regulation process, then we don't even have to go through this. So they actually kicked the can down the road, hoping that the courts are going to do this for them. But be assured, if they don't get the decision they like from the judge, which will be coming out, we believe, in the next month or two, they will be back at it at their December meeting. So this is where pro-lifers need to really be praying. We're praying for Judge Hudson, and we need to be actively waiting to engage this process.
Well, you've answered my last question, Victoria, how the concerned public can engage effectively. Yes, specifically, go to your website, certainly prayer. What else can they do?
Definitely the specific prayer over Judge Hudson as he reviews. He's reviewing not just safety standards, but can there be 24 hours waiting period for a woman to make a decision before she actually can just immediately get an abortion. He's reviewing whether a doctor has to be the one to perform an abortion. I mean, things that are really fundamental to the safety of women, whether a woman has a right to see an ultrasound. So we're really, really kind of all hands on deck praying for him. When we get that decision, we'll have better plans. We'll know what the Board of Health is going to do. But if the Board of Health has to restart this process to water down safety standards, we're going to need folks to be showing up at meetings, to be sending public comments, and we'll be queuing everyone in by way of our email alerts and through our website. So we really encourage folks to be attuned to us on our website at familyfoundation.org.
For my entire conversation with Victoria Cobb, go to christianoutlook.com. Coming up, former baseball superstar Daryl Strawberry.
I was deeply wounded on the inside, and I was searching for my identity.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They're preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Baseball great Daryl Strawberry belted 335 career home runs, most of them with the New York Mets. He was Rookie of the Year in 1983. He had a rare combination of power and speed. But quietly, behind the scenes, Strawberry struggled with alcohol and drugs. And eventually, it took its toll. You and I believe in redemption. And Strawberry found his in the sole mediator between God and man, Jesus Christ. While the two of them were at a harvest event, he discussed his story with syndicated host Eric Metaxas.
You struggled with substance abuse. You were one of the greatest athletes alive. And in the middle of that, you started dealing with the substance abuse. I mean, when did you enter the major leagues?
Well, I entered the major leagues at 1983. I came in, and I was Rookie of the Year that year. But I struggled way before that.
Already?
I struggled when I was 14. I was smoking marijuana when I was 14. I was drinking alcohol.
In other words, a lot of people would think that once you know, your career gets going and stuff, you'd leave it alone, but you did not.
No, it increased. You cross over to the next level. There's so many different levels in professional sports that guys cross over. And I assume
that there were other guys on those teams also using drugs as an enhancement.
A lot of guys. We didn't use enhancing drugs, you know, but we used, you know, recreation drugs. You know, I think, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of drinking. Come on, you're playing in New York City.
Yeah.
You become the, like, the greatest team playing in New York City in the 80s, the Mets. You know, we're going to win the World Series in 86.
Let me ask you, though. So you're playing. Most people, as they're watching you, they think everything's fine because you're putting up the numbers. I mean, you're doing a great job on the field.
Well, I'm athletic, strong. You know, I have the mind capacity of being great.
Yeah.
I have the body physique of being great.
Yeah.
And I had the heart of being great. I wasn't afraid. What I mean about that, I wasn't afraid to fail because failure was a part of it. But the inside wasn't great. Everybody could look at me from the outside and say, what's wrong? But I was completely broken on the inside. I was wounded. I mean, my father left me wounded. I think a lot of times people think, Eric, because you make millions of dollars, it's going to make you well. Money's going to make you well. Money's never going to heal you from the wounds that are up on you on the inside. And I was deeply wounded on the inside. And I was searching for my identity. Who am I?
Yeah.
Not as Daryl Strawberry to play for the Mets, Giants, Yankees, but who am I as a man?
Yeah.
And I could never get to that place.
It's amazing what a father can do with the words that he speaks to his kids. And it sounds like your father did a lot of damage.
Yeah, he did a lot of damage. I mean, it is really amazing what a dad can do. And I tell kids all the time, you know, I my own kids, I would never damage them. I always gave them positive affirmation about doing well and being the best that you can be, because I know what it was like for me when I was 15 and I was broken, but I was dreaming, I'm going to play in the major leagues because I'm going to take care of my mother. He rejected us, he abandoned us, but I'm going to take care of my mom and I'm going to bring a great life for her. And my sisters thought I was crazy because that's all I used to talk about is I'm going to the major leagues one day and I'm going to be playing.
So you entered the major leagues in 83. Did you start playing for the Mets? I don't remember.
83, I came in. I mean, I was drafted in 1980 by the Mets, number one draft pick. Spent 2.5 years in the minor leagues. I came close to quitting in the minor leagues. And they asked me to give it another year, and I went to Jackson, Mississippi. I became the Texas League MVP, and I became a ball player. I didn't become a man, but I became a ball player.
Right.
And I came up to the big leagues in 83. And my rookie year, my first road trip, a veteran player told me to go back to the bathroom, and there was. I was introduced to cocaine at the age of 21. And he said, welcome to the big leagues, kid.
At what point did things begin to go south for you? Or was it not showing until you were with the Yankees?
No, it wasn't showing in my early days, you know, playing there with the Mets. You know, I was at 21, I was an alcoholic. And by the time I got to 25, I was addicted to amphetamines. And I could not play unless I were taking amphetamines every night.
So what year did you go to the Yankees? I don't remember.
No, I left at the free agent year, and I went to L.A. I came to L.A. in 1991 after I became a free agent. And you would think, I mean, I signed a $20 million contract, but I was miserable when I signed the contract at a free agent. Well, because my marriage was falling apart. I was an alcoholic. I was a womanizer. So I came here to L.A. and signed the biggest contract of my life. And before the season even started, I went to a crusade, a Morris Cirillo crusade. And that's the first time in 1991 that I heard about this man named Jesus. I went there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Now, how did you end up at a crusade? And I want to go back for a second. So you grew up without God, without the church.
Yeah, I grew up without God, without the church, you know.
So 1991, what are you at that point? You're in your 20s, obviously.
Yeah, late 20s.
Okay, so how do you end up at a Morris Cirillo crusade? I mean, here you are. You're a big ball player. How do you end up at that?
My first wife, her uncle, he was a Christian. And he said, I just want to take you. I'm not going to force anything on you, but I just want to take you to this crusade.
Well, your marriage was in trouble.
Yes.
And he figured he may have some ideas of how you can turn the corner here, right?
Well, he never told me about it. He said, I just want to take you. It's a big Christian crusade. I says, okay. So I said, yes, I'll go. And I went. And, oh, Eric, every night that I was there, all he talked about was Jesus, and I cried every night. I sat up there, and I had to sign a $20 million contract. Everybody would probably wonder, what is wrong with him? He should be so happy. But I was weeping every night, having my head down as he was preaching and talking about the gospel.
That is amazing. And where was that crusade?
It was in Anaheim Convention Center.
So very close to where we are now.
Yeah, it was very close. And I never forget it. I always remember it because I remember Sunday when he said he was going to lay hands on everybody who wanted to, you know, be free. And I remember Sunday I walked down and he laid hands on me and the power of God came over me.
Now, when you say that, a lot of times Christians say these things. I always want to say, stop for a second. What do you mean when you say the power of God?
The power of God came over me like I could not. I mean, I've never experienced anything like it. The power of God came over me. I was speaking immediately in tongues. My belly was flowing like a river after he laid hands on me. And this guy picked me up and he says, I don't know who you are. One of his guys. He said, but God has called you. And I thought to myself, oh, my God. He sounds just like my mother, because my mother said God has called me.
Is that right?
To preach the gospel.
To hear the rest of that inspiring story, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, the Alliance Defending Freedom wins another big case.
When there's freedom for one of us, there's freedom for us all.
Details when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. As the LGBTQ community gains power, state by state and city by city, many believers have been facing tremendous pressure as businesses are being forced to directly promote that which they believe contradicts Scripture. It happened again in Phoenix, Arizona, as two artists were told they must promote same-sex marriage or go to jail. ADF Senior Counsel Jonathan Scruggs joined the ride home with John and Kathy on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
So tell us about the case involving the Human Relations Ordinance in the city of Phoenix.
Well, sure. Well, Joanna Duca and Brianna Kosky, they're our clients. They started an art studio called Brush and Dupe Studio in around 2016. They're starting this art studio, and they found out that there's a law that could compel them to essentially create artwork with the views of marriage they disagree with, to celebrate and to affirm same-sex marriage, even though that violates their religious beliefs. And the law imposes some serious penalties, 6 months in jail and $2,500 in fines per day that someone doesn't comply with it. And so left with those options, all they could do was go to court and say, court, you know, what are my rights? What can I do and can I cannot do? The Arizona Supreme Court ruled that Phoenix cannot apply its law to compel these two speakers to convey messages they disagree with.
Mm. Wow.
So every person who's an artist that produces anything, right, any visual art or music
film,
or anything,
records,
that, right, I mean, this should be a day where we can all celebrate.
Absolutely. This is a victory for everyone's freedom. And it's important to stress that Joanna and Brianna, they serve everyone, including those in the LGBT community, but they just can't convey certain messages for anyone.
I see.
And the Arizona Supreme Court acknowledged that principle. So this would protect, you know, the LGBT artists. It would protect an atheist painter. It would protect others. And that's a good thing because when there's freedom for one of us, there's freedom for us all.
So, Jonathan, this is obviously for the state of Arizona. How does this intersect with someone like, you know, the Masterpiece Cake decision? Is it the same principles in effect here?
The exact same principles. In fact, the Arizona Supreme Court said we're going to basically apply the same First Amendment principles that we think are in play all across the country. And it relied on U.S. Supreme Court cases and cases that we're involved in Minnesota and in Kentucky. So what you see now is a growing trend across the country that courts are protecting artists and protecting freedom of speech for all Americans.
I mean, dare I say, right, Jonathan, sorry, that it feels like for the first time in a while that the tide has turned towards wisdom and common sense.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right, because once you get up to the highest levels of judicial analysis, you see a consensus growing that it makes sense that we shouldn't be forcing people to say things that violate their core convictions. And that should apply across the board, not just to particular views, but all views, even views on marriage. They shouldn't be treated differently. They shouldn't be treated worse.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posian and Michael Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.